what we're doing, because this is really hard stuff. But to me, it's nothing compared to the work that our people have had to do over the last 400 years. You know, and we wouldn't be able to talk. We wouldn't be able to have this conversation if it wasn't for language warriors that have come before us. And what we get to do is we get to be those language warriors today, so that in generations to come, they'll be like, holy, you know, we have it easy compared to what they had it. You know, that's what I dream of.
Welcome to Enweighing, our sound podcast. This is a grassroots podcast intended for those raising or helping to raise children in an Indigenous language.
A special shout out to the Indigenous Screen Office for making season 2 of Enweighing possible. Gitche miigwech.
Ani wajok, miinwa kinawea.
Wajo nishnabe
dok. Ndinawe magana dok. Hey, subtle. Mashko Gavwit Dok Indigo, Mashko Gavwit Nishnabe Winakazia, Emmaline Jaganashi, Noswin. Yeah, Makwa and Dodem, Gaganishkureyak, Nbendagos, Noswin Jaba, Gaganishkureyak, Namishom Muspa, Sandy Bay, Winjaba. At Wabanung Ijin Dandis, Jawanung Ontario and Dindanungum. Yeah, Gidtam. Quid the Bodge, na Gnoswin, Gdodem.
Timigaki, Indigenous.
Ani?
Monty Migaki, Indigenous.
Oh, you cut out Monty.
Ozaugijigo, Gno and Dago. Dashkan Zibing Dunjaba, we know Dashkan Zibing the Bendagos, Mjikan Dodem, Miu and Jendayam, Dashkan Zibing, Kiwi.
Giabe, I forget, it's not the right, I'm like, I learned the word for season, but that's not actually like the it's a literal term, it's not the term for like season 2. And now I can't cookie noonwin. I think Nakuki noonwin, something like that. Yeah, we're on season 2, episode Gadwasoina. Episode 6 or something.
I think so.
Gawin Gikemasi, we the bodge mut Shrigo Optigo Jiquendum Chinendum wa Jindamut. Or is that right? I listened to him. Gindash Anish Anishayan Ninabem.
Nin Kishango and Dekos.
Panay.
Yeah, Bishrigo Mommy Quendum. Yeah, Panay and Dekos. I'm always tired.
Ikashko's Sheba.
But I'm well overall. Can't really complain.
Janagi, Maji, Kinamage, Yin. Just started a new cohort, hey?
Yeah, started.
Teaching again?
Yeah, teaching our college program. The new cohort just started. Getting settled with the class, getting to know everyone. Just establishing the language and, yeah.
Chinamami Quinn Maka Kinamagas a Jig Jajagi Giji Tawad the last 2 years. Giab Echo Nijbun Bunan?
Yeah, Wavy Giji Tawad.
Game and Ojibuk. Yeah, they did some good work and they're. Gamami Quinn Mingai. I'm proud of you for teaching them. That was a really strong group of students that came out, and yeah, we're into the new year now and we're recording a new episode. And yeah, we can start it off here. He'll be showing up in a short minute here. And yeah, we're really excited to bring you this episode today and to learn from him. Like I said earlier, Anishinaabe Hmong in the language. I haven't met this gentleman yet, but Monty spoke so highly, and I know that other friends of ours know them through other means and whatnot. And so, yeah, just very excited to get to know this individual and hear what they have to say.
Yeah. So his name is Joe Brandt, and I don't want to butcher his his Kanyegeha, his Mohawk name. So he's Mohawk from Tandanega. He'll introduce himself to you, but yeah, I kind of, you know, he's a role model for me and an inspiration, how he has raised his kids in Mohawk and his education accomplishments. And I believe he did his defense of his dissertation all in Mohawk. So that was...
Holy.
Yeah.
Holy. Sorry, can I take a pause here? Because like, hey, what?
From articles I've seen, just articles I've read about him, and there's some video on CBC about him and his family. But yeah, just reading, you know, that I think, I don't know if it was the first time, but first, especially from the University of Victoria, it was the first time a dissertation was defended in an Indigenous language and no English. Wow. So that's pretty inspiring, something that I would wish to aspire to for Anishinaabe Mwin, but I'm still beginner level speaker, and one day I'll get to hopefully be an advanced level proficient speaker. But yeah, I've been looking forward to this, like, just another like awesome individual person, role model, just inspiring story.
Yeah, I was a little bit nervous to do a season two in general, just to be on here again. But we did agree that if we came back on, we'd be having guests on. But so far, I'm like, I don't know. Like, so far, every time we have a guest on, I'm just like blown away. And like, I just can't explain the feeling I get after we're done interviewing them. I'm like, whoa. Like, I always forget every time, like, coming in, how moved, motivated, inspired, changed I am after speaking to each individual. I don't know why I don't anticipate it beforehand, but yeah, then I'm just like, holy cow, just honored to share space with the person. So yeah, really looking forward to this, and I think it's going to be a great episode. So tune in, and here we go. Much ta-da.
Hey, guys, for coming on.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the invitation. It's always good to share. I just appreciate, you know, celebrating and supporting other people doing important language work, and especially when it comes to work in the home and work with the children, you know. If there's anything I can help with and offer, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, thank you so much. I don't know if you and I have, I don't know if, like, if you, Monty, have been acquainted or not, but I'm Emmeline, so nice to meet you.
Yeah, Emmeline. I don't think so. And
yeah,
Monty, you were saying that we met in AI at a meeting.
Yeah, there's like a conference or something, and you, I think we both presented, but I think that's when I first met you in person.
Okay, yeah, I do recall that. I went to, I think, maybe two meetings of that nature. I was trying to figure out which one and how long ago it was, but yeah, it's good to see you again, and I trust all is well.
Yeah, so how's things with you going?
It's good. You know, I'm able to keep going in my language learning journey right now, and my professional work is going really well, and my family is good and healthy, and it's fun to watch every day, watch the girls grow up. Really good spot in the world.
Nice. It's awesome. Yeah, so like, I seen some of your kind of your stories and stuff online, like some news articles, and I think CBC did a video on you and your family. Yeah. So I guess for us, if you want to introduce yourself for people out there, and I guess for M-Line who hasn't met you yet, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if you don't mind, use a little bit of Kanyangeha and my name is Doho Taraje, Joe Brandt. I'm from Tainanaga Mohawk Territory, and I sit with the Bear Clan in the Longhouse. They've given me my name, and just real lucky to be with you today. And as I said just a bit earlier, celebrating, you know, some important language work, and I just want to and I celebrate as well all of the people that are doing language work in the world right now. Some people think, hey, that language work is about speaking to each other. And I don't see it like that. I see language work as a way to celebrate the relationship that we have with all of the people that have come before us, all the people that we're with now, and then all the people that are still to come. It's one of the ways that I look at language is it's an expression of all of the knowledge and experiences of people for millennia. And right now, as we sit in this time, in this space, we're a vessel of that knowledge, of sharing that knowledge and celebrating it, but also like developing it as well. One of my favorite quotes about language was from Dr. Candace Gala, and she presented at a conference called ICLDC in Hawaii, and she was opening plenary, and she talked about what language is to her, and she celebrated what she called life ways. You know, some people might call it culture, but she celebrated the fact that language is this, encapsulates all of these things of the past, all of these contemporary pieces, but also what she called was imagined futures, you know, and I just, that hits hard for me. I really appreciate that some of the work that we do every day is, it's not only for our imagined futures and the futures that we imagine for our children, our grandchildren, but there's other people of this world that get to, they get to partake in all of that knowledge that we're passing right now. It's actually for their benefit too, whether they speak our language or not. The knowledge that our civilizations have accumulated in all of our time on Earth, it's actually not just for our civilizations, our nations. It's for all of these nations of the world. And given the circumstances of our world right now, it's tremendously important that not only we raise up and celebrate all of that knowledge, but it's shared, it's respected, and it's utilized. So that's a pretty long introduction for me, but I just wanted to kind of share, like, that's the essence of the gratitude that I offer for the invitation to join you today, but also some encouragement about what we do as language workers every day. Mm-hmm. So, tokenigo nyawa.
Oh, I was just like, that's a beautiful way to open up and like start the conversation off. I say like, thank you, miigwech. And you say nyawe?
Oh, nyawe.
Nyawe for opening us up like that in such a great way and to get to know you in that way. I'm always so grateful to be able to do the podcast because like as soon as I start talking to other people doing what we're doing, you know, in their in their mother tongue, you know, it really invigorates and reignites the fire. So I appreciate hearing those perspectives right from the start and the get-go. Yeah, that's what I was going to say before. Sorry, Monty.
Oh, I was just going to say for us, just to get, just for you to understand that where our position is, we're learners of our language, Anishinaabemowin. We're parents. We try and speak as much as we can to our children. But we also live in the city too. So surrounded by, you know, English, and in my community as well, Chippewas of the Thames, we don't have any speakers, fluent speakers from our community. So we have that challenge as well. But you said you were from Tandanega. Did you, is that where you're born and raised there?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a commonality that we might be able to talk about. And the fact that, we're of a low speaker population community, much like you mentioned with your community. Yeah. I was born and raised here in Tandanega, and I always joke that, you know, I live here, I raise my family here, but I'm likely going to retire and expire on the same road that I was raised. I have this love for community that, you know, that I just don't see myself moving away from. And maybe that's a good spot to start. You know, the current environment here in Tandanega is that there's a really strong group of people working hard to celebrate and to normalize language use, and to revitalize some of our community's ties to our language and culture. And you know, I don't think that's always been the case, but I don't want to take down any of the people that have come before us too, because our circumstances are a bit different now, and maybe they were doing the best that they could with what they had, and it's really nice that right now we're doing the best with what we can, and it just keeps getting better. So although we can say that there's no first language speaking adults from Tandanega right now, and some people might argue that our dialect is dormant, Western dialect of Kanyangeha, the dialect that's shared between Tandanega and Six Nations. You know, people will say that there's no first language speaking adults remaining, and that now that we're borrowing and largely mixing from other dialects that we're learning from and learning with, it's just really, it's really important that we do celebrate, though, that there, although, you know, our dialect, you know, is in a transition phase, that we still have a tremendous love and respect for the dialect that we have and that we share. But also how lucky we are that a number of other communities have stepped forward. The dialect that comes from the eastern communities of Kanyange and Kahnawake and Ganasadage been really impactful in our community. And that's just as impactful as all of the language workers from Akwesasne that have shared and really impacted us. And you know, one of the things I say, and I try not to be too res about it, is that like I'm like a language mutt. I'm like the Heinz 57 or the Rez Dog of languages, because I don't claim to speak one dialect. You know, I've had some amazing teachers and mentors that have entered my life from all of the dialects. You know, I was lucky early on in my years to be taught by the late Audrey Ciro, who carried her parents' dialect from right here in Tandanega. And then I was lucky to be joined by Gardi Wahoe, Dorothy Lazor, who brought in like this Akwesasne dialect and this love for language and culture. And then as I continued and I went into these immersion schools, I was again reacquainted with Western dialect through Ganadawako, Gaha, the late David Maracle, and the work that they do in Six Nations, Arungawana Gunjokwa, in here, and Tainanaga at Jijunha Ungawana, you know, celebrating that Western dialect. But then, you know, completing my immersion program, we were lucky to have our first child, and we had these two amazing Duddhas that were part of a language nest here in Tainanaga. And they both lived in Ganasadage, the Wadadunyakwa, Mina Bova, and Warizose Gabriel. They had a tremendous impact on our families, my family's proficiency development. So Warizose brought in a dialect like Akwesasne, Cornwall Island dialect, but she'd been in Ganasadage so long that she also shares their dialect. And the Wadadunyakwa with a Ganasadage dialect. So my language mentors and learners have been from all communities, and also celebrate the late Mel Daibo, who worked here in Tainanaga too. And we were able to do this mentor apprentice program. The radio programs from Kahnawake that were impactful for my language learning. You know, so there's this Kahnawake dialect, this Ganasadage dialect, the Akwesasne dialect, and then the people that have helped perpetuate the Western dialect. So I borrow from each one of them, and I make mistakes in each one of them. And I try to do my best to be comprehensible in each one of those dialects. But, you know, the Heinz 57 Res Dog, that's got a mix of all of these different breeds. I kind of equate that to my understanding or my vocabulary, my language use of Kanyangeha.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like, I had teachers from as far as Minnesota to the east, and then north and south, like where we are. And I learned like five different dialects from the get-go, like different teachers all from different places. And so, like, everyone's like, your dialect's such a jumble. And I'm like, well, I'm going to use what I can. And in the meantime, guess what? I can understand like five different dialects, so that, you know what I mean, or more, just because of the exposure of different teachers, right? Do you find you kind of, when you're with one speaker, you turn, or do you just kind of use like a collective amount of to fill in? Or like, how do you navigate the different dialects?
I think for me, I'm more aware, I just become more aware of their dialect and their dialect use. And I can do some switching, and I have done some switching of particle use, and even, you know, some verbs and nouns that are more commonly used in those communities. If I'm speaking with a speaker from that community, I'll make a concerted effort to use those nouns and verbs that they're familiar with, or the particles that they use. And here in my family, though, I think like one of the great things about learning different dialects and different languages is that you actually kind of recreate one. So, you know, down the road, somebody might say, oh, that's the dialect from that Brant family in Tainanaga.
That's so good.
Right? Like, it will be that, because it's a mix of the dialects, because we've borrowed from our language mentors in all of those communities. It's just different. It wasn't that I had to follow a grandparent's dialect, or it was introduced into my home to my parents, where that was our dialect. It's going to be a mix of those. Now, I would also like to celebrate that that's how it's been in our communities for millennia. That as people come into our families, we accept them. You know, we learn their habits, their traditions, whether it's language or outside language, and we make that our own. So it's actually, in my opinion, it's a time for us to celebrate that we're on the right path, right? We're doing the things that we've been doing for years. And, you know, a little bit of transition in language use is not a bad thing. It's actually something to really celebrate. So, you know, we'll celebrate that it's happened for millennia and we're doing it. You know, I think it's a really good thing. But I do have to say too that one of the pieces of my being, whether it's my personal endeavors or my professional endeavors, is this idea of maintaining this linguistic authenticity. That one of the things that I keep striving for is that I want to use language like first language speakers use language. I want to celebrate the way that they see the world and that they've learned the world. And I don't want to take away from that based on my like second language look at the world, where English, that English lens has really, guided my perspective in my early years and throughout life. We're surrounded by so much English, right? That even though I'll just speak for me, that I am mixing these different dialects, what I want to help preserve is the real and true perspective that comes with our language. That using different words might happen, and some changes, maybe even some pronunciation changes that happens. But what I want in my proficiency development now and moving forward is to make sure that, like, I have that authentic lens, that real realistic cultural worldview that is perpetuated through language. And I want to protect that, and I want to perpetuate that, so that that we don't just speak we don't speak our languages just being English with different sounds. You know, I want to speak our languages the way that we look at the world. So dialect change happens. It's awesome. Celebrate it. But also still the work that I like to think about is, how can I still ensure that I'm, you know, I get this authentic way of being and looking and talking.
That's just refreshing for me to hear about, you know, I don't know if I've ever thought about that, like, just as a point itself of like, yeah, so many of our families came together from different communities. Like, that was essential. And like, I hear that all the time in other people's families, like not my own, because my grandparents died at a young age, but they were from different communities, you know, Sandy Bay and Long Plains. So of course it'd be a mix in the household. And I've heard that so many times, like such like different, like sub-regional dialects being in one household and then it becoming a mix. So I haven't even thought about that before, like as just by itself. So I'm like, so refreshing to hear. It should be celebrated. It's a positive thing, right? Like, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Monty, I keep getting really excited.
So I'm curious about your learning journey. Like, were you always wanting to learn the language, or was it, I know for me, it wasn't like, it was kind of a little bit about my story. My dad kind of planted the seed that I should learn our language. But it wasn't a priority for me really, even up until my mid to late 20s, I guess. So I'm just wondering what your journey was like and where, you know, how you became proficient.
Yeah, I have to say that we share a commonality there, I feel. Growing up here in Tandanega, I guess maybe I'll preface with, you know, I don't share this story out of disrespect for anyone. I respect where everyone was at, not only in our community, but in my family at the time. And, you know, it's easy to look back on circumstances that you may not have been aware of, you know, and judge. And I don't wish to do that. But in saying that, I feel that as I grew up here in Tandanega, that the use of language and ceremony was really looked down upon. The speakers that I ended up learning that were speakers that you know, that I grew up seeing either daily or from time to time, they didn't share the language, that there was definitely an element of shame that came, or reluctancy. I don't want to say shame, maybe reluctancy that came with them using the language. And that's a kind of discouraging part of my language learning story, is that I was surrounded with people here in Tanganyika that were first language speakers. Oftentimes I didn't even know that they were speakers of our language. And that's unfortunate. But in even in my family, I have to say, you know, my father and my grandfather and my great grandfather, they had to kind of relocate over to Prince Edward County for work. And although they stayed connected here to Tanganyika through, you know, through their family, through political work, they, you know, when I was growing up, it wasn't a high priority for me to learn our language or even tradition. It was more looked at as quite secondary to maybe second language learning in French, you know, and the ability to obtain employment and prosper economically through English and French, you know. And growing up, you know, and my first language exposure, you know, I think, and I want to celebrate this, is my first language exposure. I didn't even know that I was speaking Gohoina. It was just with some short phrases that my mother, so my mother's from Chatham, Ontario, and she's a English and French speaker. So in and around your area. Mm-hmm. I remember a time that I was saying, like, I don't know, like just short phrases like adu and adukes. For us is like the reaction to extreme cold and hot. And agi, to like you bunk your knee or whatever. And that you say these real short phrases that were still alive in my family when I was growing up. Because my mom was like, what are you saying? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, I'm saying like agi, you know? She's like, no, you say ouch, you know? And I'm like, yeah, it's the same. It's the same. And at the time, though, I didn't know it was like, are you so going right now? But that's all that I had in my family for language. And, you know, exposure came at the elementary school here in the territory in the NSL classes that started out as like once or twice a week. And eventually through my time at the elementary school here, you know, moved up to, you know, 3-4 times a week. And that was it, you know, like in those early years, it was about learning the colors and the animals and singing a song and, you know, and just, it was what I call exposure programming, right? Just trying to expose people to the language in a nice way. But in hindsight, the biggest impact, the biggest thing that happened in my language learning and cultural learning adventure was the siege of Gunasadage in 1990, that people called the Oka Crisis. But it was really when the Canadian government and the military, the provincial government of Quebec and the Sûreté de Quebec, decided that they were going to support the building of a golf course over our traditional lands. And what they didn't know at the time was their actions not only violated many elements of human rights and human dignity, respect for the land and respect for human beings. But what they didn't know was that it was sparking this reconnection to Indigenous nationhood, and especially in Mohawk territories, Mohawk nationhood, and was largely one of the most impactful parts of my life so far. So this is 1990. I'm real young. I don't want to give away my age too much, but I'm real young at the time. And it's an uproar in our community. You know, there was people that were going to Gunasadage and Kahnawake, to support the people that were making a stand and protecting the land, protecting the people. And then here in Tanganyika, there was also movements you know, to help show support. And that's when I realized that we were going through a really important time. And over the years, the 1990 and the summer of 1990 and the years that followed, that reluctance to learn culture and language had dissipated. And there was this rejuvenation and reconnection to what I call like Mohawk nationhood. And part of that was the revival of social beings and social activities like social singing, and the impact of the families that were involved in this, the early creation of what was called the Peacemakers Drum, a youth social singing group. Those families, the adults and the adolescents that took part in that, were that was huge. And it was kind of just following that 1990, those events. And from that, you know, it snowballed into, okay, well, now we got some people that know the songs, and now they need to introduce the songs and the language. And now that they have some language, you know, we can restart our ceremonies in the language. You know, and I don't mean restart our ceremonies. There's families that have done ceremony in our community since time immemorial, but having it openly done in the language was key, you know. And people, our young people traveling to different communities and reconnecting to those different communities was huge. So that was a major part. And then, as I said, in 1992, or I think it was around 91, 92, Gardiwahawe, Dorothy Lazor moved to our community to teach language in our schools. And and she just brought this spirit of being Ungwahunwe, like being a speaker, being a learner, and being a strong Mohawk person. And you know, this is, you know, I'm starting to move into teenagehood, and you know, she'd say, hey, if you are Mohawk, that it's because you speak Mohawk. It's not something that you just are. Like, if you don't speak, you're not Mohawk. And you know, and we had an awesome opportunity to learn from her and travel with her and make connections to her family and to her community of Akwesasne. And it was still real basic, you know. Like I look in my proficiency, it's still like novice mid, maybe, you know, real low. And I went away to university after high school. I was able to take, with Gardiwahawe, I was able to take Mohawk language classes every year up until what was at the time was OAC, right, in the grade 13. And I went away to school, and a friend of mine moved in my second year, and we always liked to be able to speak a bit back and forth, especially if we needed to say something about somebody else. But it kind of was still very, very basic stuff, and you kind of memorized phrasing. And then I went to teacher's college after that. And this was a real important point. You know, it wasn't connected to language yet, but it's actually what really spurred on this renewal of language in my life. And in one of the things about our program, it was an Indigenous teacher education program at Queen's University, and a professor in that program that really wanted us to understand what culturally integrated learning was versus culturally inclusive learning, you know, and that integration just kind of being speckles of it here and there, and culturally inclusive learning being the learning embodies the culture and language. And it was something really I had to think through a lot at Teachers College, and tried to bring right into practice right away. And I got real lucky that there was a private high school here on the territory that was centering their curriculum and their activities on our culture. So I thought, you know what, that's a spot to start. So I taught there for 14 months, right out of teacher's college, And I was really trying to understand in my practice and my being about what a culturally inclusive teacher could be or an environment. And, you know, and it was in the incorporation of ceremony, the incorporation of language and being, you know. And I just didn't have the language to say that I was doing it. Like, it wasn't a culturally inclusive environment if I couldn't center it in the language. So we're real lucky that Jijun Hangwana, the language and cultural center here in Tainanaga, put forward the first adult Mohawk immersion program in Tainanaga, like that year. So I didn't quit my job, but yeah, I took a break from my job to take the full-time program. And it was a full-time adult program. It was taught by the late Anadawakonkahan, the late David Marico, and really got to learn a lot about the morphology of the language. One full calendar year, I learned as an adult learner, and I would say that I wasn't a very good student, but, you know, I picked up some things and made some connections. Went back to teaching again the next year, and I did the same thing. I'm like, man, I still don't have the language that I need to say that I'm a culturally inclusive teacher. So Six Nations in Ungawana Gunzokwa at the time was doing a second year program. And I'm not sure if it was the first iteration of their second year program, but both they were set to my wife and I, we applied to that too. So we went, sold everything, we quit our jobs, and we moved to Six Nations. And I was lucky to live with a childhood friend of mine, Dehodat Garado, Jeremy Green. And he was raising his brand new families, his little babies in the language, and he offered us a spot to live at his place. And we got to be immersed in what he was doing. He was the only one doing it that I knew of. He's raising his kids as a second language speaker. He's raising those babies, and we got to be a part of it. So we spent our time there, you know, going to school through the day. And, well, actually, let's start earlier. Getting up in the morning, and they would, Dr. Dado would be up with his babies, and they'd be having breakfast, and they'd be speaking, and we'd get to sit there and learn from them. And we go to school, come home at lunch. Well, there'd be lunchtime for them too, you know, and then back to school. It was in the evening, same thing. You know, we shared, Dehodat Garado and I shared the love for hunting and fishing and sports and stuff. So I was able to learn from him, you know, while I'm in an immersion program. And yeah, that was the year, it was 2007. That was the year that we found out we were expecting our first baby. So we're in this program, and it's January, mid-January, and we found out that we're expecting a baby. You know, all the really high emotions that come with that, right? celebrating that and being so humbled by that. And then kind of thinking and realizing that I'm living in my buddy's basement 350 kilometers away from home. And I don't have a job. And, you know, we started to talk about moving home, you know, and put my name on the supply teacher list, reestablishing my career as a teacher so I could provide for my new family or my growing family. And Dewasetta, my wife, she just put a stop to it. And she's a real quiet person. And she was just sitting there and thought, she said, Doe Dewarunge. Said, why don't we just become speakers? She said, the greatest thing that we could do for our kids is to give them our language. And that was a statement that is just so amazing. She's so amazing. You know, as I was thinking about all these monetary things and his house and, you know, having that career to provide for my kids, she was talking about the impact of them having a relationship with all of the things of the natural world and having that grounding of being an Ungwahunai person. And that was what was going to, that's what we could offer our kids. So, yeah. So then it was like, okay, well, if we're going to do that, we better get doing it as best we can. And it was like this this re-energized language learning look, right? Where it's like, you know, without using any explicit words or anything, but it's like, oh, we only have like 8 more months, you know, to get to a level where we can raise our children in the language. We can speak to them now, and we can speak to them when they're here, you know, when they're born and into this world. And so we had lots of work to do. That's where it really kicked in. You know, those first 2 years, yeah, love, and I thank all the work that our teachers and our mentors and our educational assistants did in those courses. And I can name a whole bunch of them that were in the class. But you think too, all of the administrators and the fundraisers and all the people that were really working behind the scenes. That was great. They did amazing stuff. We were in the right place at the right time, obviously. But it was like that time, mid-January 2007, where it's like, now I have to learn. Like it was so we had to do some more things. We really worked hard in the last 4 months or 5 months of the course. We reconnected. We reconnected with Gardi Wahoe. And at the time, her cousin, Gawan, is like, the late Anne Lazor, she was in our community too. We reached out and we told them what we wanted to do. And they came to our house. And when we moved back to Tainanaga, they came to our house in the spring every week. And we started having language dinners with them and trying to build our proficiency. And then baby came. In late August of 2007, lucky that they come back to teach and learn in the fall, like when school restarted. So it was like, not even, I'm telling you, my eldest daughter was only a few days old, invited them back in, you know, and I would record all of these dinners that we had, and I would ask them questions about the baby, raising baby. You know, what's she look like? You know, what's she doing? You know, how do we describe all of these things? And so we did these Mohawk language dinners for, I think we did it for 2 years, every week recording, speaking and then re-listening, writing down some of the words we knew and some of the words we didn't, and incorporating it into our language at home. And and really shutting down all of the opportunities that English has to enter our home, you know, and really creating this immersion environment. And I know this is kind of going on here. My name is Taho Taraja. It means he comes along talking, so I can tell stories quite some time. But
no, it's good.
The one last piece that I want to celebrate, and it's not the last, but it's the next piece in this chronological story here I'm telling, is that this September of 2008. So my eldest daughter was just turned one, and my wife applied to be education assistant at the Language Nest. And the Language Nest was an amazing program here in Tainanaga, and there's many different iterations of it across Mohawk territory and elsewhere. But we had this program where two grandmas lived in a home here, and my wife was the education assistant, the support person there. And there was a small group of students, like preschool age students, that went there. She was able to take my eldest daughter there. And She was expecting another baby at the time. So there she is working at the language nest with my eldest daughter, expecting a new baby and being surrounded by two amazing first language speaking grandmas. And yeah, I was able to kind of resume my career in education. I was teaching, and she was at the EA at the school, and she was teaching and she was learning, and my kids were right surrounded by extremely wonderful people that spoke our language. And so that was an awesome opportunity. My kids stayed at the Dahne for years. Like, I think it was supposed to be only up until like kindergarten age, but we lobbied through the support of the language circle at Jizunha and Gowana, and the workers at the Dahne, the Duddas, they helped keep our children in the program even after the elementary age. And that was just amazing. Yeah, so like fast forward a little bit, 2010 until 2020, I'm in administration at the elementary school on the territory. I think it was 2010 where I started as vice principal, and I really just wanted to be like a lead learner. I didn't really have too much administrative experience, but I had this love for language and culture and community and learning. And so I started to try to find ways that I could be like that lead learner. So I got all my principal's papers, and that was a couple year adventure. And I was looking for something new. I wanted to be the teacher that was just kept on learning. And University of Victoria, they had an intake for a master's program in Indigenous language revitalization. So I applied to that and I got in. I think it was in 2014, the early, like the summer semester of 2014 when I started. And one of the opportunities that I had was to kind of write this master's thesis. And my supervisor, the late Trish Rossborough, wanted me to talk about how it's possible to raise a family in the language and create this Mohawk-speaking home in a community where we had very limited first language support, and there was a break in intergenerational transmission. There's lots of things. So it was real fun kind of looking back. It's like an autoethnographic, you know, where you're just kind of looking back at your story and trying to find these really important parts and pieces. But it was like, okay, yeah, I'm really falling in love with the idea that I can do more with language in our community. So then, my wife and I, we always kind of traded as my children grew up. We kind of traded off taking years off of work so that we could homeschool our kids and we could have them at the language nest. We could have them involved in some elementary education, but we really wanted to maintain their language learning at home and do homeschooling. So for at least half the day through their entire elementary school career, my children were homeschooled by either their mother or I. So, you know, we're into like 2017 now, and it was my turn to take the year off, and I did, and I got this job in the mornings. I was helping out with Jijunha Ngowana's Radiwanogwa's language documentation program, and I really got to learn how to record first language speakers and how to learn from those recordings. And it was just amazing how my proficiency was, my receptive proficiency through that opportunity just skyrocketed. And maybe my expressive proficiency was still developing, but man, I just loved how much I was able to learn about listening. And listening with intent and listening for understanding, you know, rather than just listening to hear, I'm trying to hear that word. I'm trying to, you know, it was like really this idea of listening to understand. So, so I was sharing how much fun I was having with this. And another opportunity came up to do some PhD work at University of Victoria under the supervision of the late Trish Rossborough, and then later on through the supervision of Dr. Onawa McIver and help from Dr. Sonia Bird and Dr. Eva Tchaikovska Higgins. I was able to do a dissertation that was centered in celebrating how to document language for learning. What could I record first language speakers so that I can contribute to second language learners' proficiency? And once again, I have to say, in all of that work, that master's work, that PhD work, the underlying goal for me was to work in the language and to help others learn the language. So doing that, it wasn't only about providing curriculum and activities for other people. It was about me learning and showing how impactful that is just in my language development. And since 2020, I switched to I just moved to a different direction in education. And through the University of Toronto now, I get to teach some language. I get to teach in a linguistics course about what I would think is called linguistic relativity, and like how language impacts thought and actions. Sustaining Indigenous languages in Canada is one of my courses I teach. But what they've offered to me is the ability to continue my language work in my community, my proficiency development work in my community, and to have an opportunity to share that with other Mohawk communities and even the broader scope of Indigenous language work across the world. So, as I sit now, I like self-assess expressive proficiency around like an advanced high level, you know, as indicated with, we use this scale called ACTFL, ACTFL, trademark. Their proficiency scale is what a lot of Mohawk communities use. Well, there's this advanced level, but there's still a superior and distinguished level. And I can't wait to keep working to get up into these superior levels. Receptive comprehension, I would say that I'm at least at advanced high in receptive comprehension. So I can understand our speakers and almost every single thing they say, even if it's a new word, I can get that understanding. So that's my proficiency story. And I know it's long, but if you know me, you don't expect anything different. The other thing too, though, is like I've set a goal that I need and I want and I will move myself into that superior proficiency category. And I have a time limit that I'm putting on that. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to stop learning at that point. But and the best thing that I can do for my community right now and the Kanyagahaga Nation is to become the best speaker that I can and learn and share. So that's the opportunity that I'm looking, straight down the barrel at right now. And I've started, to really put in place some steps to do that. So that's where I'm at right now. And as I said, it's not a learning journey that's going to end, but I think I want to celebrate all of those people and those programs. Because if like looking back on that story, you know, we have exposure programs in elementary school. You know, we have more sustained what would be called like NSL, Native Second Language Programming. You know, we have a high school program that's supported with a really inspiring teacher. You know, immersion programs, and the development or the continuity of a second year program in adult language work, and then the idea that there's opportunity and need for supported self-directed learning, and that learning can be tied to the home, and that there needs to be intergenerational support, that language nesting is an amazing practice, that independent and self-guided studies has to be part of language learning, that learning from first language speakers is tremendously important, especially in communities of low speaking populations like ours. We can utilize documentation, their recordings, in order to develop our proficiency. So, you know, as I said, when you asked about proficiency, yeah, I did give a long story though, but all of those programs are important. And, you know, I think each and every one of us, we may have different priorities and different circumstances to access those programs, right? Is like the ability for us to access those programs is really important. So, my story is pretty long sometimes.
No, that's all right. There's so much in there that is so important and critical to hear. I think, like for me, there's like so many points where I'm like, whoa, that I'm mind blown. So many points I want to talk about too. This is kind of like through that whole thing. There was one thing that kept popping up for me. Like there's a couple of things, but like your determination, your motivation is like so strong. This is like a personal question for me. how did you manage, or is there any strategies or like mindset of drowning out the noise to stay on your like target goal? Like through all of that, I can't imagine like also like all the random like tedious things that happen in daily life that, you know, can wipe our motivation off the plate or our goals off the plate for the day, or like things that happen in life. Like, is there anything specific, or I know that's a huge question, but like that helped you drown out all of that to stay on your course?
Yeah, I'll try my best to share.
Yeah, that's a huge question. I know.
I'll try my best to share. Like some of those motivations, like I'm a real stubborn person, and when someone or something presents a task where, you know, it's questionable whether I'll do it or not or be able to do it, then that's normally the motivation where I'm going to do it and I'll show you kind of thing. And that's just part of my personal way of being, that I feel like there's nothing that's insurmountable. And this is one of those areas where, you know, it's a tough go. And maybe because it's tough, that gives me a little extra motivation to do it. But to be honest with you, when it comes to strategies, I'll talk about and maybe ask a question about what language loyalty means to, you know, to us, to you, to others. And it stems from what I just shared, because there's no doubt that some of our work, our language work, it's difficult. We can say that it's rewarding, and we know that it's rewarding, but there's some challenges. There's specific challenges to Indigenous language work and learning that don't exist in other realms, you know, of second language learning, where there's millions of people in the world that speak the language, or there's a geographical area where you can go and that's all you hear. You're immersed in it, where it's seen in all of the contexts of life, from professional life to personal life, in the home, outside the home, in community, intergenerational, you know, like that's the reality of second language learning in other contexts. We really, in Ganyangahaga territory, we don't have that. And it's about creating that for yourself, and making deliberate actions and plans and practice to really support yourself in ensuring that your language is always at the top of the priority list. So, when in my master's work, I had an opportunity to learn from the late Joshua Fishman's work, and he did a lot. And some people regard him as the godfather of language revitalization, for revitalization of Hebrew and whatnot, and other languages throughout the world. But one of the things that really stuck out was this phrase called language loyalty. And language loyalty for us, as I just kind of tried to frame, is a lot different. How do we learn and use and celebrate our language even when we're in a community that's not doing that? Or even if we're in a community that does do that, but only in certain places. It's the mindset that obviously and perpetually I have to make language right at the top, and I don't care where and who and when. It's always going to be there. So, you know, especially when people enter this realm of this advanced proficiency, this movement towards what people might characterize as native speaker-like proficiency, there is a need for self, like a self-directed question. And that is, how loyal are you to your language? What does language loyalty mean to you? How bad do you want it? How bad do, how many sacrifices are you willing to make to learn and to speak and to share the language? And I think that speaking proficiency can be equated to the degree of loyalty that one has with the language. And it's not just a mindset, it's actions. It's this deliberate practice of doing that likely is the most important. So I can't see that as a specific strategy that you go back to, you know, in a specific circumstance. But I feel like it's all tied to this idea that the language is, we have this reciprocal relationship with it. There's things that I need to do in order to learn from and with it. And there's certain things that the language gives to me it's like a breadcrumb that helps me on my way. And, you know, if I'm not willing to search for those breadcrumbs and utilize them the way that they should be used, then there's a break in that relationship. So the question I ask is, you know, how far are you willing to go? What's your language loyalty like? What in your scale? What's your level at? Because I think based on that level, realistic, long-term, ongoing, in all these different circumstances, with different pressures and different people in your lives, if your language loyalty is still that high on a scale of 5, if you're ripping at 5, what I think is that there'll be a correlation to the proficiency that you're able to obtain. And and varying strategies, like you said, a specific strategy that doesn't really resonate with me. But there's so many tools that we have. Like, we're at the moment in human history and civilization where there's so many opportunities to learn and so many various ways that one can learn and connect to the language that we need to take advantage of that bounty and use the ones that work with us for as long as they work with us. Because sometimes those strategies, they're awesome at maybe at this level, or maybe when I'm this tired, you know, that strategy really works with me. But, you know, when I move up a proficiency level, maybe that strategy doesn't fit so well. And, or maybe I have this extreme motivation and I'm going to, you know, use another strategy because I'm in that point. So that's important. And I think that this, the second piece, maybe if I can, it would be about reclaiming domains, like the places and spaces where you only use the language. And the most important domain is within the home. So that has to be not only the foundation, but all of the support structures need to have the home embedded within it. And unfortunately, what I see in our Ganyangahaga territories and some other indigenous language programming is that it doesn't include the home. And if we take a look at the environment wherein our language programs operate, they're largely institutionalized. They're in a building that looks and feels way different than the home does. So if one of the main indicators of the normalization of language use is the use of language in the home, then our programming and our efforts, our practice as language learners needs to have the home domain as its main focus. And some people laugh when I say that you need to systematically reclaim domains of your use. And the easiest thing to do is to reclaim the domains where you're isolated first. It's easy. And to me, I think there's two spots in your life wherein it's easiest to reclaim that domain as an Ungwahuayneha only domain. Number one is your car and or your mode of transportation. It might be walking, it might be biking, or it might be on the transit system. You can choose what language you're using and hearing for the most part. Because in the car, you have the radio. On transit or walking, you have a headset. And you can choose your language input. And if you have some recordings, or you've made some recordings yourself, you can continually listen to that. And yeah, it might be quiet in the car, but if the rule in your car is, when I'm in my car, that's all. That's all. It's just our language. I'm listening. I'm speaking. If you're driving by yourself, and nobody's judging your pronunciation, your word choice, you're just speaking, and it doesn't matter. If there's a family member in there, you just got to tell them the rule. You know, I'm going to talk and I'm going to listen in the language. And you don't say anything unless it's in our language. Like, that's the way it is. Don't tell me how to drive unless you can do it in Anishinaabe Moin. Imagine that being a rule, you know? So, and one of the other reasons I say that to learners is because normally they have to drive to or from. Like, they have to transport to or from their school, you know, where it's institutionalized. Well, this is our way. This is our first step to deinstitutionalize it. Something that's part of my normal life. And then, you know, you systematically take over your home. Okay. What's the space in your home that's most isolated? Okay? It's the bathroom. Right? Normally you're in the bathroom by yourself. If you have children, you likely don't have that opportunity so much, but but there's time. Every day we spend time in the bathroom, every single day. And normally, not all the time, but normally it's by ourselves. We can control what we hear and what we say in the bathroom. That's the next, in my opinion, that's the next domain. And you systematically take over, you know, next to me, next bedroom. you know? Okay. And next, where's the spot? It might be the kitchen table, because maybe we don't have all the vocabulary for cooking yet, but maybe we do have enough vocabulary to ask how we're doing today. You know, maybe we get to identify some of the pieces that are on the table, the things that we're eating, these types of things. But the systematic reclamation of domains centered in the home, not exclusive to the home, but centered in the home, I think is the next action, or one of the actions, whichever sequence it takes.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. Awesome advice. Things that, you know, I've done in the past, like, and kind of still do, but it's not like fully like a full on rule, but, you know, just driving along, listening to recordings or whatever. Same in the house. Just making like you're saying, like claiming that and like making that the priority. You know, it's how far do we want to take it? And I always think about, for learners, I think, or for other people wanting to learn, you know, that kind of sounds intimidating, but I think that's like your next step. So as you're learning, you know, make that next step. And that's where we're always thinking about, okay, I learned the beginner stuff. Okay, what's my next step? And then what's my next step? And I think that's part of that. On our learning journeys.
I agree. What resonates in what you said to me is this ideal of what's been coined deliberate practice, that it has to be planned, it has to be impactful, it has to be measured, you know, it has to be prioritized. And that continual practice, I'm making this a deliberately choosing this for this reason, and these are the steps I'm taking to enact it. And continually I have to keep asking myself, is there something that's working and not working, and how can I keep making it better? And, you know, I think that's a really important part of what I understand from what you just shared. It's a deliberate thing. It doesn't just, the stuff doesn't fall out of the sky. You don't get to dream. You don't get to lay down one night and become a speaker the next day. You know, it takes some very serious and dedicated and deliberate work.
Go ahead, Monty. I was just saying, like, the reframing, all of that was just like very helpful for me. Cause yeah, I don't know if strategy is the right word. I was just looking for like, what is your mindset, or what do you do, or how do you speak to yourself to keep moving on a road when, you know, life decides to just like throw stuff at us here and there nonstop. And how do you, you know, drown that out to stay on course? Because it's so easy to like fall off the path for a bit and then you get yourself back on. And it's like, how do you avoid, you know, letting those things like take you off course of like your goals and whatnot? So wonderful reframing of like the reciprocal relationship between you and your language, and like it also like you having to feed it and it having to feed you back. And then, the idea of, what can I do to support my own learning? Like, what can I do to support myself so that this continues? Yeah. And I know that I'm just reiterating what you said, but like very, very, very helpful for me as a mother.
That's good. I appreciate that. Yeah.
You go ahead, Monty. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I was just wondering if you could talk about, I know we have different family structures in our communities, but you talked about how your kids were doing half a day homeschooled through their whole elementary. So like, how did that come about? How did you was the school like just receptive to that, or did you have to kind of challenge that a bit?
Well, my circumstance in that regard was a little bit different. I was the vice principal at the time of the elementary school. So that's an important part, but not as important as the willingness of the staff and the administration at the school to accept it. That's an important part of your being and your family and your children's growth and development. So it wasn't difficult. It did take some planning. It did take some give and some take, this reciprocal relationship. But it was tremendously impactful in the continuity of language use for my children. I would think that it's likely one of the most important parts of my children's ability to be able to express themselves in our language today. Because don't get me wrong, all of those early years were really, really important. The time that Dewaset, my partner, and I took off of work, the dedication that we had to the Kanyangeha being the language of our home, the support networks that we created and were supported by, the language nest, all of those things in those early years, tremendously important, to the point where my children were extremely highly proficiency speakers, equivalent to elder speakers and their ability to comprehend and express themselves. But one of the things that we know of this world that I live in right now is that if English has an entry space, it just takes over. You know, it's, you know, look at world's history. This happens to people and places, and it happens to language too. That if you give it that crack that door open a little bit, boom, it busts it right down, takes over everything, does it all, you know? So we were protective of that, but we were also under the understanding that, you know, that our children were and are going to be bilingual, and that's okay. Multilingualism is amazing, you know? So with that came the opportunity for our kids to go to school for that. They were already going to be bilingual, whether the school was involved or not. But an important part of their early years to me is all of those important things that you learn in kindergarten. You know, there's a saying that everything that you need to know in your life, you learn in kindergarten. It's about sharing, right? It's about taking your turn. It's about supporting somebody else. It's about asking for help, all of those things. So the education system that we're involved in this part of the world, that doesn't celebrate that is actually the most important part of elementary school. It's about building friendships and learning these social rules that come with being a respectful human being. So we wanted to give them that opportunity to be a part of that and learn and make friends and have fun. But we also knew if they were going to be there all day, that it was just going to take over. So, you know, we were able, or we were lucky enough in our situation to be able to do what we could to work with that. And all the teachers and the support staff, the educational support staff at the elementary school here, and the administration were all in support of it. And, you know, as I said, sometimes there was a really cool event that was at the school, and they'd be like, hey, can your daughter stay all day? Be like, yeah, absolutely, you know. And then sometimes we just take them out of school for a week and you know, maybe we go to another community for ceremony or we'll go somewhere else, you know, and we just worked together at that. And I will also say this, you know, there's this fallacy, this myth out in the world that learning a minority or an indigenous language takes away from someone's ability in, you know, in a common language, in this case, English, and or that, you know, the focus on indigenous language education takes away from the academic achievements of a student. I am here to tell you that our experience is absolutely 100% the total opposite. That my children's ability to express themselves in English is great. Their academic achievement throughout their elementary school career, and now we're getting to the point where my eldest now is entering her last semester of high school, and every single year since she was in junior kindergarten, she has been commended in many different ways for her extremely high academic achievement. My youngest, same. Extremely high achieving academically in institutions where they only attended largely for half the time. You know, their ability to speak English it's not been negatively impacted by their ability to speak another language. And the, you know, this colonial, especially in colonial Southern conservative Ontario, that we should be monolingual English is, and these myths that are out there that promote that, and people that promote these myths are well off the base of what reality is. And I'd encourage us as learners, as speakers, as teachers, as parents, and, you know, all of the generations, grandparents and young people, that you don't give up something because you're learning your language or speaking your language. You actually gain much more than you'll ever give. And so, you know, as I said, the support that came from the community, amazing. The teachers, the administrative support, amazing. And the achievements of my daughters, and it's not because of the language, it's because of who they are and what the work that they've done and put into this. They're really amazing people, you know, that just happen to be first language Kanyagaha speakers. And I think that's something I'd like to celebrate.
Wow.
it's an awesome story. Yeah. I'm glad you're able to share it with everyone.
Yeah, that's awesome. I, as part of just this little side story, that now that my daughter's, you know, getting towards her graduation of high school, I'm just so proud that she's right now, she's looking at a career in being in education. She wants to be a teacher. She's made strides to apply to university programming, but also has made strides to applying to adult immersion programs, and is just, what an awesome opportunity. I really appreciate that you know, as we get to this transition in our family's life, that we've still been able to maintain a kind of a love for learning and a love for teaching. And one of the tools that she has, and one of the gifts, I guess, that she can share is that language. So, you know, I really hope that she pursues her dreams, and whether it's this dream that she continues on or others, you know, I think it's really awesome opportunity for our family to give back. As I said, if it changes to a different direction, that's great too. But right now, you know, as she, you know, puts her university application in and her look towards next year, it's still in there. That love is still in there. Yeah. That's something that I just want to celebrate.
Oh, you can let her know that we're rooting for her as well. Just like whatever path she takes, right? But that's really lovely. Like, yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, my kids can be whatever they want to be, but I really do hope that they end up in language somewhere down the line.
Yeah. Well, I do, though, as we come to the top of the hour, I do have to get going. Yeah.
Just so thankful for everything you shared. Is there anything that you like want to plug? Do you have anything out there you want people to
promote for people to find?
Yeah. You know, I don't know if it's anything specific, but you know, in my story, none of my story we wouldn't be talking about this without just amazing people doing amazing things for generations. You know, we're at the point in our history or our civil, like our day and age, where this is actually, to me, this is easy. If you can think, if you think of what our parents and our grandparents, and then if we go back generations and generations, what they've had to do in order for us to be able to speak our languages today. Right now, I don't want to reduce what we're doing, because this is really hard stuff. But to me, it's nothing compared to the work that our people have had to do over the last 400 years. You know, and we wouldn't be able to talk. We wouldn't be able to have this conversation if it wasn't for language warriors that have come before us. And what we get to do is we get to be those language warriors today, so that in generations to come, they'll be like, holy, you know, we have it easy compared to what they had it. You know, that's what I dream of. But so for a plug, or for an offer of gratitude and respect in closing, it's to celebrate that many people have shaped the story. And I hope that I've been able to celebrate their legacy, their impact on my family. And I'm in mentioning them by name in these stories, but there's other people that I wasn't able to mention in these stories too. The ones that are working behind the scenes, the ones that are working that I just wasn't able to mention, but I wouldn't be here, and my family and my language and my community and my nation wouldn't be in this situation if it wasn't for all of the people that have come to this point. So I really appreciate the opportunity to share their stories, my perspective on how they've shaped my life with you today. Yeah, go ahead.
I have one more request. If you can share something in Mohawk to other learners, other Mohawk learners, like some words of inspiration.
Yeah, only with you. Well, on a good day, what that's on, I ain't a easy getting on qua in the guy and so what the way us to, yeah, go on a knee her that name. Then on the end of the jail of the qua lay jar. Tinika does that go on had jay, on a hour name, I zarlunke, and go right now. Qua says ski canor on Tinisa derha. Then he's at Nigon Lord. The got Neos, the Zajero Haji. Then, Aguirian, I gave Dick Dakwa, Snake on one of Dusla. Tinigo, Yadoni Sulage, the Zatgon Haji. When I out, nay. And he's a daddy and go in there, or Sadawian still go in there. I say de hiarlo ne, say un gua, o na awat ne, ne guato gaon, and you don't have de un gua neha. Ya te de doc dani jini ganorlo, jini so what yaro haje. The long gua le jaran ji say gone to the wakwisla. The no agiro oni gua. De tina, de tina, la dun go, nung That's all I got.
Yeah, I think I could talk to you all day long, but I also have a class I have to run to. Okay, and awesome. We really appreciate you sharing space with us, sharing your knowledge with us, being willing to come on. Like, I think this is really going to impact so many people, so many families. So can't extend my gratitude enough for all of the knowledge that you carry from others that have shared with you and your own experiences. Yeah, we're very, very grateful to have you on today.
I appreciate the opportunity and offer you the same thanks and encouragement to keep going. Your work is really impactful. And I appreciate the opportunity for us to meet today. Maybe our paths cross into the future.
Yeah, it would be great.
Take care of yourselves right. And your family.
Yes, you as well.
Nagitwai.
Nagitwai.
Chimigwech gob zindao ye kinawea. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast, Enweighing Our Sound. To reach us by email, find us at oursoundperiodpodcast@gmail.com. You can find all of our links to Buy Me a Coffee, Patreon, Instagram, etc. at our link tree, which is linktr.ee/enweighing.oursound. Our theme song was done by myself, Neen Mushko Gobwood Kwe, and artwork completed by Nishime, my younger brother, Brent Beauchamp. Chimigwech.